ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Nightlife Tech. Nightlife Tech. Well, two new wars have broken out on our computer desktops after a period of relative stability in two common areas of desktop computing, web browsing and image editing. Heated competition's broken out in recent weeks. It used to be Photoshop for images and Chrome for the web. Right. Joining me is Peter Marks, software developer and technology commentator from Access Informatics. Peter, good evening to you. Welcome back to Nightlife.
Thanks, Philip. Good to be with you.
Now, starting with Chrome, remind us of the early days of web browsers. What were the choices?
Oh, well, there were lots. In the early 90s, there were many notable web browsers. We had Mosaic, then we had Netscape Navigator, and finally Microsoft Internet Explorer, IE, which was bundled with Windows 95 and came to dominate. This was the big browser war that led to antitrust legal action against Microsoft because of that bundling. There were some smaller players with innovative features like Opera that came up with tabs, which are now in every browser. So it was a really creative, vibrant time, and that's kind of gone away. Internet Explorer, as I said, came to dominate because it had unique bugs and quirks. Because so many people used it, sites had to design their site to make sure they worked with IE. And it became very hard for alternatives like Firefox to compete with them. But, Philip, it was the smartphone revolution after 2007 that finally unseated IE and opened the door for Apple Safari, which runs on iPhones, and Google Chrome, which runs on Android. And of course, Google Chrome is now the dominant web browser on everything, on desktops and everything.
Why is it so important anyway? And what's the new war that's broken out?
Yeah, so whoever controls the web browser has an opportunity to watch what billions of people are looking at and to guide their choices. Microsoft used IE to push people towards Windows and their Office products by just making sure that it worked best in their browser. Google uses Chrome the same way. They use it to learn what we're interested in because they can see what sites we're reading, so they can know for targeted advertising. And they also make sure that they remain the dominant search engine because just typing into that bar goes off to Google. But now we have a bunch of AI companies that are so valuable, they're basically propping up the US economy despite the best efforts of their political leaders. And these AI companies know the value of being the browser, and so they've entered this war, they've created this war. There's a ton of products launching. We've got OpenAI has ChatGPT Atlas, Perplexity has Comet, Microsoft Edge has Copilot Mode. Google is now including AI summaries, and I bet there's a new version of Chrome in the works that takes that even further. And there's other little ones, Deer, Sigma, and Brave, which all pay AI companies for the smarts they're building in. So an AI web browser changes the typical use from searching the web for an answer to just asking the question and having it give you the answer. So they also promise future agent capabilities where they'll be able to operate the web browser for you, and you can say things like, find me the cheapest flight and we'll go and look at all the offers and find the best one, maybe even make a booking in the future. A great feature is you can also open up a complex web article and just ask questions about it because they can read what you're reading and you can get a summary or an explanation. So, Philip, the idea ultimately is that AI can use not just its own training but also your computer and your private info so it can do tasks on your behalf.
Yeah, although when I've used it, I've thought that's the end of – this is the future of search and browsing, you would think, the AI. But, I mean, it does – it sounds great. You say there might be drawbacks, though, of using an AI browser.
Well, the big one is, of course, privacy. I mean, at the moment, we're being spied on all the time. Our internet service provider knows what websites we go to. Google, of course, knows your search history and what you look at. But look, buckle up for the most intrusive privacy attack we've had to date. To do what they're promising, to be an agent for you, they need access to everything that you look at. They read what you read. They look at your email. They remember everything. Now, we often trade privacy for convenience, you know, automatic log on to services using Facebook or Google, of course, gives those sites a lot of information about what you're looking at. There's an old saying, well, maybe not that old, but if you're not paying for a product, you are the product. And another big drawback of this AI you know, revolution where you just ask questions rather than going to sites, is that traffic to content creators is trending down. The large language models have been trained on everything on the internet, and they can answer questions without you actually going to the, you know, the author's pages and seeing ads. So it's a bit like their business model's being destroyed, a bit like when the classifieds left newspapers and destroyed their business model. Even sites with paywalls are finding that these AI browsers can piece together the gist of a paywalled exclusive content article because of chat or mentions or quotes elsewhere. So it basically reduces the strengths of those paywalls. But look, Philip, presumably what we're seeing is the AI companies, the business that provide training material for them, they're basically hoovering up everything that's out on the internet, and in the end, fewer people are going to visit original content. So that's the first conflict, a new kind of browser war.
Yeah, you mentioned two wars. What's the war over image editing?
Well, certain apps like Chrome come to dominate and be the standard. I mean, if you're applied for an office job, it helps to be skilled in Microsoft Office because it's the default, I guess. When applying for a graphics job, it's been knowledge of Adobe Photoshop. Now, Photoshop is such a common app that it's sort of become it's an adjective. You know, this well, was
that's right.
an adverb.
It's been Photoshop. It's been Photoshop.
Exactly, yeah. So even if you've never used Photoshop, you're aware of Photoshop. Like the early days of browser options, there are many alternative editing packages like Krita, GIMP, or Pixelmator, but Photoshop dominates in professional settings. It's complex and it takes time to master. It's also quite expensive and you have to subscribe these days to use it. Adobe, the company that makes Photoshop, has quite aggressively embraced AI in their software, and they can see the writings on the wall. But these AI features actually reduce the skill you need. Things that used to require a lot of graphical skill, things like cutting a subject out of the background or removing something from an image, required a lot of skill, but you can now ask an AI to do that for you, and they're getting really good. Now, an Adobe competitor called Canva was founded in 2013 in Perth. It's an Australian success story. Mm-hmm. It's been very successful in not just graphics, but also things like copywriting. Last week, they launched a Photoshop competitor, very capable, called Affinity Editor. It's a very full-featured graphics editor. I've had a bit of a play with it. Now, Photoshop requires a subscription, as I said. In Australia, you have to make an annual commitment, and that works out to $36 a month.
That's expensive, yeah.
But Affinity Editor is free.
Hello.
Hello, Adobe. You do need to create an account to use it. You need to be logged in, but it's free. What kind of business model is that?
Is this the old thing, a bit like ChatGPT too? You offer a free one, everyone gets on it, thinks it's indispensable, and then you introduce a charge, is it?
Well, they say it's going to be free forever, but yes, you do pay. They have AI features and you do pay for them. The other thing about these packages, these complicated packages, is there's a huge inertia that prevents people from switching. Even if there was something better or cheaper than Photoshop, people have learned Photoshop and they might have started using it as students, and it takes time to switch. So I think that by offering Affinity Editor for free, and in particular for things like students, they'll pick up millions of users who, once they're familiar with it, will take it into the workplace. The great hope, as you sort of said, is that all of the AI businesses believe that eventually we will pay for AI because it does something that we would have to do manually. So it is free now, but there are upgrade paths. Adobe is nervous. On the 1st of November, just a few days ago, they held a conference for 10,000 marketers and content creators to persuade them that they are adapting to AI. But the company's shares have lost a quarter of their value this year. So it's the investors who aren't so sure. So look, I think, Philip, it's going to be interesting to see how Adobe responds. Maybe we will soon see Photoshop for free.
Mm-hmm. All right. Everyone dreams of buying a new TV. Well, maybe not everyone. And when you go and buy one, there's always some gimmicky marketing thing going on, isn't there? And for a while, it used to come in terms of letters and initials. You've got to get the new Q or L or A or whatever. And then it came with resolution. And so you had to have a 4K TV. Now there are 8K TVs available. Shops now carry 8K TVs, but are they really worth it? What's the history of TV set upgrades anyway?
Well, it's an amazing history, and you could suspect that this is designed to get us to buy a new set every other year.
Well, I'm sure it is.
I mean, television broadcasting took off in Australia in 1956, so people could watch the Melbourne Olympics. It was only in Sydney and Melbourne, and of course it was black and white with a big glass tube at the front of the wooden box. Mm-hmm. We were late to colour in Australia in 1975, and happily that meant we were able to avoid the US standard known as NTSC, which technical wags used to call never the same colour. Mm-hmm. And over the years, look, TVs have got bigger and better, and the colours improved. Flat screen TVs were the next big innovation in the late 90s. Do you remember how big the tube TVs were?
I can remember. Massive. And they were huge, and they were heavy. So,
they were. Mm. I remember we had a Pi, I think it was a Pi, it was all screen in front, and there were stories about them exploding or imploding or whatever. I don't think they really did, but anyway. But yeah, flat screen TVs were great, and that really was a trigger for everyone to go and get new TVs. And they've gone through several technological revolutions. We had plasma TVs, went to LCD, and more recently OLED. And there's all sorts of variations. You mentioned some of the letters that we see there. At the same time, transmission started to go digital from 2001, and analog broadcasting was phased out region by region from 2010 to 2013. You could still get set-top boxes to keep your old set going. But one of the big failures, I think, was manufacturers trying to get us to buy 3D TVs.
Yeah, that, had to that buy... never worked, did it? No.
No, you had to wear special glasses there. I think it was the Avatar movie that was very popular in 3D that triggered a lot of sales, but I think 3D TV is the biggest failure in consumer electronics marketing. I mean, people bought the sets. There's no content. There's no broadcast that I know of anymore.
So that was
a big deficit.
It's a dud. It's a bit like quadraphonics, I think.
Yeah.
We in hi-fi. What about screen resolutions, high definition, etc.?
Yeah, the flat screens and digital broadcasting enabled the screens to increase in resolution. They used to be just 576 lines by 720 pixels, which sounds tiny. Standard definition digital was also 576 lines, but it was generally clearer. High definition came along in the early 2000s and was confusingly either 720 or 1080. ABC TV actually just switched off its standard definition digital channels in July. So I guess everyone with the early sets that couldn't do high definition have now upgraded or perhaps stopped watching. The current selling point is called ultra high definition or 4K. And I don't think there's even any regular 4K TV broadcast in Australia. So people are getting the content from streaming services. Because of the way streaming does video compression, it's debatable whether you really get a full 4K clear picture.
Is that right?
Another story.
You buy a 4K TV, you're not actually watching 4K.
Well, it compresses it, so it depends on the bandwidth, and it can be quite soft, even though it's 4K. Mm. Now, TV manufacturers, as you mentioned, including Samsung, Hisense and LG, are now offering 8K TV sets. They have a resolution of 4320 lines by 7,680, and it's that horizontal, the 7,600, which they're rounding up to 8,000, Philip. It's just amazing to me that we've come from 576 lines to 4,320 lines in about three decades. Just amazing.
But the point is, would we notice the difference? Do I need an 8K TV?
Well, it seems to be you don't. No. You don't even need 4K, according to scientists at the University of Cambridge. They've concluded that for an average-sized living room, a 4K or 8K screen offers no noticeable benefit over a similarly-sized 2K screen. In other words, if you're sitting on the couch, there's no tangible difference when it comes to how sharp an image appears. These high-resolution screens, they're great for computers, and we're all, you know, luckily able to use larger computer screens. But for watching a movie on the couch, there's no benefit. Actually, it's interesting. Even many movie theaters are only 2K. You don't realize you've got a better picture at home than you do in the movies. Personally, I have a 4K TV, and I do think it's worthwhile. But if you want to spend money on your TV viewing, I would spend it on the sound, because that's a lot of what you enjoy when you go to the theater. The only other enhancement is called high dynamic range, where you get very bright areas, but even that is little used. I don't think I've ever seen it in broadcast, and it's only occasionally on, you know, sometimes Apple TV has it. But look, I'd save you money. Maybe 4K, but I would just ignore 8K for the moment.
Peter, always great to talk. Thanks for the tips. Thank you.
Thanks, Philip. Good to talk to you.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.